Natalia.
I'm Atiki Ochi in Montreal. 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Keep on rocking the free world. Keep on rocking the
free world. Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. Though it's hard, you will find to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your...
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live, feminist radio heard once a month on CKUT at 90.3 FM. We're on the air for the next hour and we really hope that you'll stay with us. My name is Rosemary Wally. I'm joined by Sister Collective member Brisna Kajero, and from Vancouver by a sister in struggle, Wendy Mendes. Both Brisna and Wendy are from Guatemala but have lived in Canada for years. From 1960 to 1996, there was a genocide in their country, and both of them have relatives that were forcibly disappeared and assassinated. The exact number of people murdered is not known, but it's estimated to be 200,000, with 40,000 kidnapped and 440 villages destroyed. Stealing the land from the Mayan people was played a big role. Both Brisna and Wendy continue to work for peace and justice in their home country, and today we're going to be looking at a very small but very significant step in that direction, in the direction of justice, a trial of a few ex-military perpetrators known as the Military Diary Trial, the Military Diary Case. Which will be held in September. So let's start by asking, what is the Military Diary Case?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this interview with CKUT. I'm very happy to be here to be speaking about the Military Diary Case. The name is given to a document that was extracted from the Guatemalan Secret Intelligence Archives and sold in the United States to the National Security Archive in 1999. This document logs and registers the kidnapping, the abduction, and torture and extrajudicial execution of approximately 183 people from Guatemala that were considered internal enemies during the war, particularly during the period of General Oscar Humberto Mejia Victorez. And so, of course, you know, family members of people that were abducted and disappeared in the 1980s, when those actions took place, quickly began all the process to search for them, right? To search for the loved ones. Where were they? Were they in the hospital? Were they in the morgue? Were they being detained, etc.? And so since then, really, since 1983, 84, and 85, family members of the disappeared have been searching for them in many different ways, presenting all kinds of complaints before authorities, etc. However, this document was made public in May of 1999. So 15 years had already gone by where family members had been searching for information, searching for the whereabouts of the disappeared, and this military document is made public. So it came to reinforce what the family members already knew about the kidnapping and who had been behind the kidnapping and abduction of her family members. So in 1999, family members once again got together and began to present a process in the national courts, right? Because this became another proof, right? Another piece of evidence of what had been happened during the war in Guatemala. And for several years, the Attorney General's office never really paid attention to the case. They wanted to put the case into 183 different cases rather than see it as a collective systematic practice that occurred in Guatemala that forced the family members to take the case into the Inter-American human rights system. And in 2012, we were able to obtain a sentence in the military diary case, right? If you look it up, it's called Miguel Gudiel, Jose Miguel Gudiel and others versus Guatemala, where the state of Guatemala was found responsible for the disappearances and recommended that they must investigate in the national courts in Guatemala, who are the perpetrators, and above all, what is the whereabouts of the disappeared. And so at this point in time, in May 27th of 2021, 11 military officials belonging to the military intelligence were arrested. And since May 27th of 2021, they have been presenting themselves before Judge Galvez, who is a high-risk judge that oversees these type of, the name says it, right? High-risk cases, and has already indicted the majority of them for crimes of forced disappearance, extrajudicial executions, and other crimes against humanity.
What was the cause of all this horrible violence in Guatemala?
Thanks, Rosemary. I think one really important thing to mention about the war in Guatemala is how the national security doctrine that was implemented from the United States to Latin America, particularly during the Cold War, really set the stage for the way that people were being identified as internal enemies. So anyone that the governments that were not elected, right, we're talking about dictatorships, we're talking about generals that committed coup d'etat, right, one after another to be in power, you know, during all of this time, they implemented to the letter this national security doctrine that particularly during the Cold War saw anybody that spoke against the government as internal enemies. And so, for example, people that were opposed to the dictatorships, people that maybe had more progressive type of thinking, that were unionized, that were student leaders, that were community representatives asking for, I don't know, clean water, right? Were seen as internal enemies. And so anybody that was opposed to the dictatorship and what was happening was seen in this way. And so that really opened the possibility for a lot of these violations against human rights to be committed during the war. I think that's one really important element to take into account, as well as the way that forced disappearances were experimented in Guatemala and then taken to other countries as a way to silence opposition and as a way to generate and create more terror in communities. In Guatemala, there was approximately 45,000 people that were disappeared, that are still disappeared and we are still looking for. And among those 45,000, there is approximately 5,000 children that were disappeared. So many of our brothers and sisters, our little brothers and sisters, are also disappeared, and we're also searching for them. We have hopes that not only to find the remains of our parents that were disappeared, in my case, my mother was disappeared by the military, but we're also hoping to find in life, right, although much older, like my age now, brothers and sisters who are also missing.
I would like to add something else to this point that Wendy have presented very well. But I think that the problem is also that Guatemala has been invaded, oppressed, and exploited by international economic interest. And just to mention two countries that we are very connected to, is one is Canada and the other one is the United States. The United States has been a great supporter of militarism, and Canada is a producer of munitions and weapons. And actually, not many people know that, but they provided this type of support to the Guatemalan army regimes, either via the United States or at some point, like in December 1985, they sold directly those weapons and technology to the Guatemalan government. So I think that that gave kind of like the base to have some people unsatisfied with the system, because that, I mean, those actions brought poverty, exclusion, racism, and injustices. So people that organized themselves, as Wendy already mentioned, because they were against the system, even sympathizers, or even people that were just happy that something like that was happening, all of them were considered like internal enemy of the state.
Yeah, I think also, you know, when he was mentioning the Cold War and other countries, and at the same time as this was happening in Guatemala, similar things were happening just next door in El Salvador. And another thing I remember, because this is going back some years, and maybe some of our listeners didn't even know this, or maybe not even born then, but there was very poor media coverage. I think it was partly because Guatemala is such a very, very dangerous country and remains so for media workers. It was not sort of like every day on our TV screens.
I appreciate the comment around how this level of violence coming from the state forces were not only happening in Guatemala, but also in El Salvador and other countries, other regions, other countries in Central America. And I wanted to mention Operation Charlie. I think listeners can go and look into this. This is similar, a plan that was similar to Plan Condor that was used in the southern cone of Latin America, where governments that, you know, were also experiencing a dictatorship, were exchanging information on political opponents and surveilling and persecuting them in the other country, right? So, for example, in individuals that were considered internal enemies in Chile might have been in Argentina, for example, and the Argentinian government would persecute them and surveil them in favor of the Chileans, or the other way around, right? There's also cases of Chileans disappearing in Argentina by Argentinian state forces. And so something similar also occurred in the region of Central America. This is called Operation Charlie. Of course, this provoked a lot of great violence and a lot of loss of lives. One thing that's really important to also mention, you know, sometimes we talk about the 45,000 people that are disappeared as a number, but if we begin to see who they truly are, we're talking about teachers, some of them were doctors, some of them were farmers, campesino farmers, you know, people that are missing today, right? Intellectuals, poets, people that today could be sitting here with us talking about how to solve the situation of the country, right? Or participating in their community, doing all the work that they were doing. So it's not just about the number, it's also about the loss of the quality of participation and these human beings in our own communities and in our families.
People must have quite high expectations that they've got this far for the trial.
Yes, right. Currently, the family members who are bringing forward the case, so the Attorney General Office in Guatemala has a special unit that investigates high-risk cases that are linked to the internal armed conflict, right? So anything to do with war crimes, they are investigating these cases. One of the expectations is that the prosecutors and the auxiliary, you know, researchers for these units, is particularly the one that's investigating the military diary case, remain protected, that they remain in their independence to investigate, and for them to be, you know, allowed to do the work that, that they're doing, particularly because we've been working with them quite closely, trying to provide further information, right, bringing testimonies, bringing documents that maybe family members had that have been kept, you know, hidden or, you know, very well saved, that because we hadn't been into a trial, right? You know, the military diary was made public in 99. So even if we counted from 99 to here, that's over 20 years of waiting for something to happen. But in reality, we've been pushing the case in different ways and different generations as well for over 37 years. And so the expectations are high in terms of we want to exercise our right to truth and justice. We want to bring these military officials to trial before a judge so that they can also break their code of silence and finally tell us, where are the disappeared? Where is my mom? Where is my uncle? Right, where are all the children that they disappeared? We really need to find them. We believe that it is our right to give them a proper burial. And for us to finally begin, I guess, you know, after 37 years, we haven't even been able to begin a mourning process. You know, the family members of the disappeared, and this is one of the characteristics of forced disappearances, right? It was designed that way. Is that the family members of the disappeared and their communities or their workplace where now they never went one day, for example, really feel the impact of being up in the air, not knowing where we stand, not knowing where our family members are. It's a really difficult situation that we live every day, not knowing where they are, not knowing where, for example, we can go leave flowers. For us in our culture, it is so important to have that relationship with our dead. It is very important, not just on the 1st of November. And so the fact that we don't have their remains to be able to have that connection with them is really a type of torture for us. You know, not knowing maybe today is my mom's anniversary of death. And here I am not even talking about it or not even, you know, commemorating it somehow. So that's one of the other expectations that we have for this case, that through it, the military officials that are being on trial right now can finally break their code of silence and tell us where our loved ones are. And of course, we want justice. We want justice to be served. We've been waiting for this to be clarified for over 37 years. And I think that after the peace treaties were signed in Guatemala, transitional justice still has a long way to go for us to even talk about national reconciliation. And so justice has to be served before we even talk about those other issues that are so important for our society as well.
No, I think Wendy really put it very clearly. I agree with those expectations. Those are our expectations, to find our loved ones, their remains, and also bring the perpetrators to justice.
Are the chances high? I mean, this is a case that's so important. It's so riveting. But are the chances high that the perpetrators will actually be brought to justice, that they'll get prison terms at least?
I wish I had a crystal ball.
Oh, okay. So it's a possibility. It's an authentic trial.
Well, and not because the case is not solid. So I think that one thing that's important to mention about the Guatemalan justice system today is that some of the cases for genocide or for crimes against humanity, for example, that have gone before this particular case, we have seen that the defense lawyers, the defense of the military, are not really litigating the case in terms of defending their defendant, because how can you defend genocide? There's no way to defend genocide. There's a reason why these crimes cannot be left in total impunity, right? As in, you know, or be in, under amnesty, for example, right? There's a reason why, you know, globally, universally, these crimes can be persecuted. We have seen that they have used different types of tactics to litigate, right? So, for example, more public opinion and pressure, creating a circus inside the actual trial. Right? Questioning or re-victimizing, extremely re-victimizing witnesses during the trial, you know, so they break down and tell them where to go. I don't know, things like this, right? That's what we have seen. And I think that's how the defense lawyers of this particular case are going to go. If we are to just go by the evidence, right, that we have right now, the military diary has already been authenticized as a real document, not just by Guatemalan experts, but by experts in international experts, right? As Kate Doyle, for example, of the National Security Archive in the United States, who's an expert in declassifying government documents, for example. But not just a military diary, the Judge Galvez himself has even said in some of the hearings, the first declaration hearings, that if we took away the military diary, that document itself, the case stands still on its own, because there's also other documents, other evidence, right? And so in this case, for example, the National Archive, no, it's called the Historical Archive of the National Police. It is also a series of documents generated by the National Police during the 1980s that document the repression and document, above all, the contact or the coordination that police forces had with the army to carry out joint actions, right? And joint actions, I mean the abductions and the persecution that we already mentioned, right, from the disappeared. And so there's also witnesses, right, people that were, for one reason or another, able to survive the torture and were able to escape. People as myself who are also a witness, that I was able to see police and military officers during the abduction of my mom, right? So I know that because I know my memory. I know that I'm a witness to that. And like me, there's other people that are also providing their testimonies. So, you know, we're really happy that we're able to exercise our democratic right to access justice, right? For non-repetition for us. Coming to the courts and bringing these military officials to trial is our way to contributing to non-repetition, right? We don't want anybody ever in Guatemala or anywhere else to have family members being disappeared in these ways. And so I think that's one important thing to also mention. And so in the context that we're living right now in Guatemala, where the Attorney General has illegally dismissed a prosecutor that was investigating anti-corruption of the government itself, right? And put another person in. This woman didn't want to follow her orders either. And so they changed them again, right? In a couple of days, I don't know how many hours, really. They've been changing the prosecutor that investigates corruption. And they put somebody that we know is in favor of these acts. And so, you know, in that context is, you know, I wish I had a crystal ball, because we really don't know that what can happen, right? I think that if something bad happens in the case, it's going to be these type of actions that are illegal, that are just to re-victimize and continue attacking us, right, and victims and survivors of the genocide. But otherwise, you know, if we are to think of the rule of law, and that we're trying to defend, I think that we're going to achieve really positive results. I think that our society needs these people to be tried and punished so that we can finally close these dark chapters of our history and move forward.
What courage it would take on the part of the witnesses.
Los ojos de los enterrados se cerrarán juntos el día de la justicia, o no se cerrarán.
¡Está! Estamos aquí para reivindicar la memoria del pueblo Isil. Estamos aquí para decir, aquí en Guatemala, sí hubo genocidio.
Ríos de sangre los que lloró la tierra después de tanta masacre en tiempos de la guerra. Y no pienses que esto se quedó solo en los 80. Tantos pueblos arrasados de una forma tan cruenta, tan violenta la manera de quitarle agua al pez. El ejército asesinó una y otra vez. Como piensan desde el odio, hacen todo al revés, defendiendo intereses de los ricos tal vez. Usted no se haya dado cuenta, pero el exterminio a pueblos mayas tuvo intención de genocidio. Plan Sofía lo decía, y de matar mayorías. Qué casual que en esas tierras hoy haya minería. Fusiles y frijoles para reeducar, son campos de concentración para latinizar. Ríos Montt, no lo niegues, te vamos a juzgar. Cuántas veces necesario voy a testificar. Claro que sí, sí hubo genocidio. Lo sabe este cuerpo porque en él no hay olvido. Intenta borrar la historia, yo escribo la memoria. Escucha esta canción, es sentencia condenatoria. Claro que sí, sí hubo genocidio. Lo sabe este cuerpo porque en él no hay olvido. Intenta borrar la historia, yo escribo la memoria. Escucha esta canción, es sentencia condenatoria.
Es genocida, no soy yo.
Nunca podrán imponer amnesia histórica en nuestra memoria colectiva.
Yo estoy luchando.
Los genocidas no somos nosotros.
¿Qué cara tienen ellos que no hubo genocida? Sí hubo genocida, porque
el genocida es Río Montt.
El pueblo Isil ya te llevó a juicio. La jueza Jazmín Barrios dijo, él sí lo hizo. Durante días escuchaste el suplicio de gente tan valiente que se niega al olvido. El poder logró que se anulara el proceso. Empresarios dinosaurios forzaron el retroceso. Lo que ellos temen es que ya perdimos el miedo. Renacimos de la tierra con todos nuestros muertos. Claro que sí, sí hubo genocidio. Lo sabe este cuerpo porque en él no hay olvido. Intentas borrar la historia, yo escribo la memoria. Escucha esta canción, es sentencia condenatoria. Claro que sí, sí hubo genocidio. Lo sabe este cuerpo porque en él no hay olvido. Intentas borrar la historia, yo escribo la memoria. Escucha esta canción, es sentencia condenatoria.
Genocidio no es ya solo una lucha de nosotros en el país, sino que también es un reclamo en el mundo que se juzgue y se condene a los genocidas en Guatemala.
Sí hubo genocidio.
So, Wendy, can you tell us your story? What happened to you in Guatemala?
Born in Guatemala, and when I was 9 years old, I was coming home from school. When I came to my home, I noticed that there were police officers and military officials inside my home, and that they had abducted my mom, right? She was being detained there, being asked different questions about, who knows, right? About the people that she knew, about where she worked, you know, asked, right? Like the family, things like this. And so ever since then, the last time that I saw her was in their hands, right? I never saw her again after that. My family began to look for her immediately after that. And I was forced to move to the countryside. This happened in the urban, like in Guatemala City.
Mm-hmm.
And, after my mom was abducted, I was forced to move into the countryside with my grandmother, and later on came into Canada as a refugee with my dad and my older brother in 1985. Ever since then, you know, living here, right? I've always lived here in Canada. But I did return to Guatemala for many years in 1999, actually a couple of weeks before the military diary was made public. So it's kind of, I always thought of it as a sign that I needed to stay in Guatemala and to work around human rights issues. So I returned to look for my mom, right? I hadn't realized that there were so many people that were disappeared. I actually still had the idea up until I went back to Guatemala in 99 that my mom was maybe a political prisoner, was my hope, that I was going to be able to find her, that I was going to be able to talk to her, even if she was, I don't know, in whatever conditions she was or they had her, right? I used to think about that. But no, right? A couple of weeks after I returned to Guatemala, I realized that wasn't the truth, right? That the military diary was made public, and began to work with organizations around human rights issues. I became one of the co-founders of an organization called Hijos, which is made up of sons and daughters of people that are disappeared in Guatemala, working on historical memory processes, on recovering truth, right? Accessing justice. And so, yeah, that's a bit of the story, a bit of my story.
Yeah. Brisney, you have anything to add? What were we going to talk about next?
I would like to say that I really admire Wendy's work, because, I mean, she became a human rights activist, and she has been very actively involved in the case, not only her mother's case. She's not just searching for her mother's remains, and but also all the other victims of crimes against humanity that she's been working and supporting. And not only in Guatemala, but also she has supported other other struggles in Latin America. So it's Wendy's really an unbelievable person in terms of the amount of work that she puts every day. I think she doesn't sleep because she works a lot. And it's, to me, it is impressive.
Oh, very impressive, yeah. Very, very impressive. Very difficult work to do. I think that we should maybe look at what's happening now in Guatemala. Why are the people rising up at this point?
At this point, I know that there has been over a week now of a national strike in Guatemala. These actions began, it was one day of protests, and then people began to add themselves, right, and call themselves onto the strike. And so there has been mobilizations of communities, of organizations all over the country for over a week now. And this was provoked by the action of the Attorney General Consuelo Porras in illegally dismissing the anti-corruption prosecutor, Juan Francisco Sandoval. And so people began to realize that we're not going to be able to move forward and actually live in a democracy if the Attorney General themselves is promoting or allowing corruption to continue, right? Or will only prosecute those cases of corruption where it doesn't involve her friends, right? Or her, you know, contacts, let's say. Yeah. And so that situation is continuing to evolve every day. Sometimes in the morning I see a news piece, and by the afternoon the situation has already changed. In terms of new scandals or new things that are happening, right? I knew that, for example, maybe in the last month or since the end of May, right? There has been several scandals that have come out into the news regarding corruption or regarding, you know, anything, right? Some, you know, bad news that are coming up. However, some of these are being used as a smokescreen to cover up the fact that there are government officials who, one, are being accused of corruption or let go, right? Where, for example, a judge has dictated that a government official is not guilty of corruption or that there is not enough evidence to prosecute them, even though there is, and they're let go, right? So that news has never really made it that big into the national media. However, that is something that is happening as well. And just recently, I think there was one of the sons of a former general, Otto Perez Molina, was arrested, I think, for over corruption, maybe yesterday or today. And again, right, we're waiting to see what smokescreen this is for, right? Because they try to blow up this in the news. However, there's other actions, maybe worse, that are happening that don't make it so much into the news, right? I think that's one thing that is happening right now in Guatemala. And another element, which is really interesting, is how the, especially indigenous communities, so we're talking about the ancestral traditional authorities who for, you know, hundreds of years have, communities have always had their own ways of government. They are demanding a plurinational assembly to be established in the country. This is really, really important. This is a demand that has been built and constructed by the communities and the popular marginalized peoples of Guatemala since 2015, if not more, right? So for many years, when another president was brought down because of corruption, the communities have been working around this and the possibility of truly being represented in government. And in this case, through a plurinational assembly. I know that there's other countries like in Chile, for example, who are taking forward and are much more advanced in these type of community processes and consultation democratic processes. But I think in Guatemala, there's also a possibility to do that.
Yeah, very inspiring. Yeah. What about these people that are leaving Guatemala and walking towards the Mexican border? The press that they get is absolutely disgusting. You know, they're simply not taken seriously. They're considered to be, you know, like poor and ignorant and, you know, stealing jobs in Los Angeles sort of thing. It's just horrible the way it's reported. Why are they leaving?
The trigger of these mobilizations, people wanting to go to national strike, the trigger was that Consuelo Porras, the attorney general, destitute head of the office that works against impunity and corruption. But the majority of the people are living under poverty. I mean, the government is corrupt. I mean, now that we have COVID, there is, not really the necessary services to people who need the vaccination. There are not enough vaccines for everyone. The hospitals are underfunded. And if we talk about the communities in the countryside, the victims of not consultation, I am going to mention then again Canada, that Canada has so many extractive companies in the area, and they are being ignored. I mean, the communities are being ignored. The extractive companies, either mining or whatever they do it with a high level of contamination, and they do not respect the prior informative consultation to the communities, the indigenous communities. When the COVID was in place, also the president at some points declared state of siege. People that depend on selling their products, taking the products to the market, they were not allowed to do that. However, Coca-Cola or the type of sodas, they were allowed to go everywhere and sell their products. So people are really tired and fed up of all of these situations happening in Guatemala. The fact that, for instance, the Canadian companies have licenses to exploit the resources and then do not contribute to create jobs, do not pay any taxes, and do not do anything to invest in the environment that they damage. So I think that people are fed up with everything. And also, on the other hand, you have the government trying to reverse any advance in justice. And that's why they try to attack the human rights attorney, to anyone who is trying to build a country with justice and respect and dignity.
Yeah, I think it's more than being fed up. I mean, these people are a victim of Canadian injustice. Because one of the reasons why we can sort of sit here, you know, sort of fat and healthy and eating, is because the people in Guatemala are absolutely exploited. Guatemala is a branch plant of the U.S. and of here as well. You know, as you say, they don't pay taxes. The mining is done without the consultation of the local communities. I mean, it's just unbelievable that companies like Tahoe Resources just fly in these little helicopters, decide that there's something under the ground that they absolutely have to have, and wreck these communities that have been there for thousands of years. And I don't think that Canadians are aware enough of the bad things that Canada does.
I don't think they are. And I remember in 2005, when there was there were demonstrations against Glamis Gold, Canadian corporation, in Guatemala, the Canadian ambassador sponsored a chief from the Creek community, the Creek band. His name is Jerry Asp. So the Canadian ambassador invited him to come to Guatemala to talk about the benefits that the Canadian extractive companies provide to indigenous communities. Ironically, while this Jerry Asp was in Guatemala talking about it, his office was occupied by the Elders Council, and they were saying that Jerry Asp did not represent indigenous communities' interests, and they were demanding a stop in mining in their area in BC.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember all this is done, all this, you know, inviting people hither and yon, you know, it's all done with our tax dollars. Our tax dollars don't just provide hospitals and schools, they do that as well. But they are used as grants for companies like Pratt & Whitney here in Montreal, Bombardier. These are military companies. They're also used to provide so-called diplomatic services for companies in Guatemala.
Yeah, I think it's important to also mention how sometimes in Canada we're just so comfortable, right? With the rights that we're able to have, right? Rule of law is respected. You know, sometimes when I speak to people, Canadians around what is happening in Guatemala, they're like, yeah, but isn't there a law that protects that? It's like, yes, that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting to defend the rule of law, but it doesn't fully exist, right? Or exist only for a few, or we have to, you know, work that much harder just for the rule of law to apply to the regular people, right, to us. And so I think that's one thing, like people can't really imagine what it's like not to have that, not to have the rule of law, or can't really imagine what it's like to go through a war, or can't really imagine, you know, what it's like. And it doesn't mean that you absolutely have to go through that and it be to be able to identify yourself with that or to empathize. I don't think you should have to live that in your own, you know, flesh and blood to feel compassion and to feel solidarity for other peoples that are also struggling, particularly when we're benefiting from that in one way or another, or we should have a say of, you know, where our taxes should be going to, for example. Yeah, it's not an easy subject to touch, I think. I know that, for example, in the military base of Coban, number 21, which now is called Creon Paz, in the late 1960s, this was a community that was forcibly displaced by the military because they wanted to put another military base on their own community, and they were displaced, and they have been displaced since that time. Today, that military base was turned into kind of like a UN type of mission for training UN officials. Of course, we already know what UN missions have done in Haiti. I'm not saying that that is what is happening in Guatemala. However, I do question why the Canadian government funds Creon Paz. Why do they fund this training center when they know that this land has to be given back, right? You know, sometimes I hear the struggles for land back in Canada, and I really agree with that. Because I know what it's like for demanding land back in Guatemala. And that's one case, for example, where the Canadian government could definitely play an important role, right? And well, at least not, you know, not funding a program on somebody else's land, you know, that could be step number one, right?
With our tax dollars.
Exactly, yeah. And then they sell us the idea of, you know, how Canadians, how we are always promoting peace. I think maybe at one point, I used to be very proud of that when I returned to Guatemala. I was like, yeah, but I'm Canadian. I'm not from the U.S., right? I'm Canadian. You know, we're the peacekeepers. We're promoting those values. Through the years, when I begin to see, you know, that's one narrative in the discourse, but in the practice is something different.
Yeah, well, Canada's foreign policy really does need taking out of the bag and shaking and reforming. It's terrible, yeah.
Yeah, even well, to me, it's also shocking because same as Wendy, I used to believe that Canadians were so good. It's only when you start reading it, seeing things, first of all, that are being done here to the indigenous communities as well, and the racism that exists here as well. And then you dig more for information. I was surprised to find out that the Canadian interest in Guatemala comes from the 1950s. And even when the United Fruit Company was in Guatemala, it was a Canadian, Van Horn, who built the railroad in Guatemala to a really high price that was paid by, of course, the taxes of people in Guatemala. And also the interest in the mining companies come from a long time ago. And also it's military support. So it's kind of like a side of Canada that it's not really well known by the general public.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that it's not well known, because I do believe, you know, separating Canadians from the Canadian policy, I suppose, right? Because I believe Canadians are good people, that if people had the information for themselves and realize what the government is doing in their name, they might have a different position on what is happening today.
Yeah, I was wondering about the drought in Guatemala and the extent to which that is really compounding the problems that people already have.
Yes, this is climate change, or I guess global warming, right? Or more specifically about how that's impacting in Central America and Guatemala particularly.
Yes.
Yes, it's definitely one of the reasons why people are fleeing the country and looking for other opportunities for them and for their families. Many of the impact on the land, for example, or on the environment, better yet said, has also been the monoculture. So, for example, palm oil companies that take over like vast areas of land that maybe was being used to generate food for the communities or even for export, right, or for national or the national markets, that's no longer possible. So people don't have land to, you know, grow their own food, or the impact that these type of agriculture, monoculture has on the land is really bad, right? Because they can no longer come back to it to harvest other food. Also because the amount of water that it takes to compare to the amount of rain that they have there because of the global warming. Now there's less rain in certain areas where there used to be enough, right, for that land, right, naturally. That has also been having a really big impact. So after the palm oil is done, the land, it can no longer be used, right? The level of recovery that it needs is many years, as well as a lot of investment, right? From the companies, et cetera, from a national program or something, it would have to be. So that's definitely something that is pushing people out. In some areas, the drought has continued. Normally, there would be maybe a drought of a year, let's say, right? A bad year or something. But now the time that the drought is lasting is a lot longer. And in other areas, there's way too much rain, right? So we're talking about flooding or when they have something that's called alud, which I can't remember now in English, I guess land shifts, right? It comes with like a mud and landslides. All of that is having a really big impact as well. And of course, you know, we've experienced maybe in Canada, certain heat waves that have happened. We know that this is directly linked to other things happening in other parts of the world. So we're definitely interconnected, right? Something, you know, a fire burning in Brazil purposefully burned these ancestral forests in the jungle in Brazil. And we know that that has an impact directly on the weather in Canada, for example, or vice versa. And so in Guatemala, it's the same thing. You know, some of the impact of these companies or of the environmental changes that are occurring right now are definitely having an impact in Guatemala and on their people. I also want to say that there's even rivers that these big companies divert just to be able to use that water in mining projects, but mainly around these mega monocultures, palm oil, for example. So they'll divert these rivers that are a source of food, that are ancestral, you know, traditions around the rivers, right? Like the rivers are not just a river and the water, right? They're part of the community. And so those level of impact that it has on the culture and our, the identity of the communities is what's really pushing people out of the country as well.
Yeah, I agree with Wendy. And I wanted to mention that actually the diversion of rivers for palm oil cultivation, but mainly for the extractive companies. Just to extract nickel, you need 45,000 liters per hour. It's a lot of water. And that water was used by the small farmers in Guatemala, because most people in Guatemala have small pieces of land where they cultivate the products that they are going to consume, and they can sell a little bit, besides the large plantations that you have. If the majority of people were dedicated to agriculture, it's like they were taking their source of income away. And besides that, you have the criminalization of the defenders of the territory and the persecution. So people really have like no hope in Guatemala, and they try to go to other places.
In Guatemala, one of the biggest income is actually the remesas, the money that is sent from families that are already living in the States, that have been there for decades already, sending their families a bit of money, right, to cover the cost, to feed the kids or to put them in school, etc. And so it's not that migration from Central America to the United States is something that is new. Maybe it's not even something that has even increased that much. Right. I mean, I think now we have a lot more documentation about what is happening, or the stories maybe are being told a lot more. But migration and people working in the United States has always happened for many decades. And people will not be continue to be allowed, right, or to travel, for example, and to seek refuge and asylum in other countries, which is also a human right. The conditions in Guatemala need to change. But also, you know, what will be the impact of not receiving those, you know, small transfers that are happening in Guatemala? That's going to be another crisis. So for the listeners, we would like to invite them to commemorate with us on August 28th from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon Guatemala time. We will be having an online event to commemorate the International Day of Victims of Forced Disappearances. This is going to be an online public event. We're having some music and presentations by analysts around the military diary case, as well as, you know, like I said, music and maybe a bit of poetry. That will be shared on some of our social media, but mainly you can continue to follow the case in Spanish. We're also going to have information there in English. If you follow on Facebook, Famdegua, at FAMDEGUAG, Famdegua G, you'll be able to follow information there around the event that we're having on August the 28th from 10 to 12 Guatemala time.
So we're going to actually get ourselves either a Facebook page or a web page, and then we're going to post this information about the military diary case. I think that's the best thing. We haven't got it at the moment. But unfortunately, our time has really trickled away. There's so much background information on the internet about the military diary case, planning this Facebook. Meanwhile, we wish everybody the rest of the summer to be very, very good for you. And stay tuned now for our next show, which is a Mandla African News Programme on CKUT. Yeah, we'd like to thank our guest for today's show, Wendy Mendes, who is talking to us from Vancouver. So thank you very much, Wendy. Good luck with this case, and our love to you.
Que tiemblen los jueces y los judiciales. Hoy a las mujeres nos quitan la calma, nos sembraron miedo, nos crecieron alas. A cada minuto de cada semana nos roban amigas, nos matan hermanas, destrozan sus cuerpos, los desaparecen. No olvides sus nombres, por favor, señor presidente. Por todas las compas luchando en Reforma, por todas las morras peleando en Sonora, por las comandantas luchando por Chiapas, por todas las madres buscando en Tijuana.
Cantamos sin miedo, pedimos justicia, gritamos por cada desaparecida.
Que resuene fuerte,
nos queremos vivas,
que caiga con fuerza
el feminicida.
Yo todo lo incendio, yo todo lo rompo. Si un día algún fulano te apaga los ojos, ya nada me calla, ya todo me sobra. Si tocan a una, respondemos todas. Soy Claudia, soy Esther y soy Teresa. Soy Ingrid, soy Fabiola, soy Valeria.
Soy la niña que subiste por la fuerza.
Soy la madre que ahora llora por sus muertas.
Y soy esta que te hará pagar las cuentas.
Justicia, justicia, justicia.
Por todas las compas marchando en Reforma, por todas las morras peleando en Sonora, por las comandantas luchando por Chiapas,
justicia, gritamos por cada desaparecida.
Que resuene fuerte,
nos queremos vivas,
que caiga con fuerza
el feminicida.
Que caiga con fuerza
el feminicida.
Y retiemble en sus centros la tierra.
Thank you. it takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM, your weekly African news and analysis show. So the Amandla team has decided to take what we would consider a well-deserved break. We're going to take the next few weeks off, but we've taken time to pull out what we consider some of the best of our programming over the last year or so. During these strange times of COVID, we nonetheless managed to pull together some interesting and relevant information. So Doug has kindly gone through our archives and pulled out pieces that we think bear rebroadcasting. So for the next 3 weeks, folks, we will be gone, and the faithful staff at CKUT will be making sure that these shows hit the airwaves every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Montreal time.
Je voulais faire un petit retour sur la situation qui est prévue en Algérie. J'ai pour ce faire trois excellents invités. Il y en a beaucoup d'autres, donc notamment des militantes qui sont mobilisées, qui auraient pu être là, mais pour toutes sortes de raisons. On se retrouve avec une délégation masculine. Je tiens sincèrement à m'excuser de ne pas avoir de présence féminine ici, d'autant plus qu'il y en a qui sont impliqués dans la communauté. Mais pour toutes sortes d'impondérables, je n'ai pas pu en avoir, mais je vais pallier à ce manque d'aujourd'hui. Dans les prochaines émissions, je vous donne ma parole. Pour ce faire, donc, aujourd'hui, j'ai trois invités qui sont tout à fait sensibles, pareillement, aux enjeux féministes. Monsieur Brahim Rouabah.